This is continuing with James Trexler on 18th March, 74, from the other side.
I was talking about the calculated risk in designing and starting construction on the 600-foot parabola at Sugar Grove. One of the features of this system that was so difficult, it made it become so expensive and so difficult to do, was the fact that as time went on, it was allowed to grow in complexity. It was felt first that if you were going to spend so much money and so much effort on a large antenna, that you should at least make it operate to 3,000 megacycles, as we called it in those days, to 10 centimeter wavelength. And this was a very great burden on the mechanical design. And the second feature that made it difficult was that National Academy of Science decided that if you're going to spend this much money on a large radio telescope, it also should be a large radar telescope. And it should have the largest and best transmitters available to work at the highest frequencies possible. So those two...
For radar astronomy?
For radar astronomy.
Oh, I didn't realize that that was also a goal.
So right away a staff was assembled and work was started on a 1 megawatt CW, continuous wave 1 megawatt transmitter to work it at very high frequencies on this. And this brought up all kinds of problems about danger to aircraft flying overhead and all these kinds of complications. The going up in frequency brought up the problem that no structure, no matter how carefully designed, as at least as conceived at that time, could possibly have enough rigidity to work
right
at a wavelength of 10 centimeters. So that to overcome this very difficult problem, it was decided to make the antenna continuously alive and adjusting, self-adjusting.
Right.
This became an extremely complicated problem.
This was an entirely new concept.
This was a new concept. There were alternate concepts underway. MIT was working on a way of stressing, pre-stressing and controlled stressing of the structure by building in sensors and stressing members in the structure to hold a shape. There were servo-controlled antennas under design in Australia at the time. But the concept to be used at Sugar Grove was quite different, and that was to, if I can say it backwards, was to place a perfect parabola in the sky and connect it to a flexible steel support structure by continuously operating hydraulic jacks driven by sensors that were optical sensors. And these were all connected to an Invar steel tower, which was the base line at the center of the structure.
Mm-hmm.
This Invar steel tower was to take the total Invar output of the United States for 3 years. I'm saying
incredible.
These to give you, I'm giving you some gee whiz numbers
right
so that you understand that it wasn't a small project in anybody's imagination. A lot of this went forward. A special factory was built at the site in West Virginia, the largest factory in West Virginia at the time, multi-story, very elaborate, to build the surface of the parabola.
These were panels, I presume.
There were to be 100 panels, approximately 100 panels, and each one was to be built on site, being much too large to be transported in. And they were to be built as precisely as possible and stored outdoors in a three-year cycle and brought back in at the end of 3 years for trimming up after they cured in the natural environment. And they were extremely well made, and they were rolling out on the production line at a reasonable rate. There were 13 of them spread out in the curing yards at the time of the cancellation of the project in 1962. And if you think that each one of these panels was large compared with most radio telescopes, and cost about $250,000 a panel, and they were just the surface panels
right
of this dish. The structure was being built by two mobile gantries, which were much larger than the gantries used at Cape Canaveral or Cape Kennedy. for the launching of the big rockets. And they were not only, there were 400-foot gantries, they're mobile gantries. The structure itself rose to almost 200 feet above the ground before cancellation. The criteria for cancellation was very well studied by McNamara's office in Department of Defense, and it was determined that technology had outrun the proposal, and that the country couldn't afford to support the new technology and the old radio astronomy or radio technology, and therefore the older system at Sugar Grove had been overtaken by events.
That was mainly on the military side.
The military side. There was no support, there was no appreciable support, no real support from the scientific community for a project of this magnitude. The when the project went beyond the cost of $250 million, then it became popular in the press and in the halls of Congress to talk about the latest cost of Sugar Grove, and if you didn't have a bigger number than the other man, you weren't up to date. So the cost immediately started escalating by $100 million steps day by day, and soon killed itself because it was in the same category as a nuclear carrier or some other very, very large national project, and was under constant scrutiny. So the project was canceled. The steel and fabrication work that had been accomplished was dismantled and sold mainly for scrap. And the residuals were mainly in the area of technology and a few facilities left at the site. For example, a large operations building is used today by the Naval Radio Station.
Right. 150-foot dish there.
And there are some smaller dishes left at the site, which have been in operation since the 1960s. But the 600-foot dish probably ruined for astronomy field the possibility of building a large dish in the United States, which is very unfortunate.
Yeah, put a bad taste in the mouth of Congress.
That's right. And this is indeed unfortunate. But the technology developed on that dish did help in many other projects, and may have helped eventually in the building of some of the larger antennas, such as the one in Bonn, in Germany. This was mainly due to the fact that large numbers of design people were brought together, and it did work on the project.
Did the radio astronomers back it in the beginning anyway?
Radio astronomers were, well, I think on the one hand they were happy to see a large facility being built. On the other hand, they were unhappy that they weren't directing it. I don't think the radio astronomers could muster enough support at that time to build an instrument of this magnitude.
Right, I'm sure they could.
And probably would not have. The concept was growing at that time that large arrays were more cost-effective, and for some purposes this is certainly true. For the military purpose, it was not true. We were unfortunately stuck with the problem of maximum gain, and maximum gain in the smallest possible area. So we need to fill the aperture, which was required this kind of a solution, so that it was unfortunate. It's interesting to note, though, that the predecessors of the Sugar Grove system, which is described in the IRE article, really was the forerunner of the Arecibo dish.
Right.
And there was a period in time when a large antenna based in Puerto Rico, 1,000-foot dish in Puerto Rico was considered to be a possibility instead of the Sugar Grove antenna. The reasons for making the change was that the large fixed dish in Puerto Rico didn't have enough coverage time. It couldn't follow objects long enough.
Right.
And it would require building more than one to do the job. Originally, it was planned to build one in Hawaii and one in Puerto Rico. To get more coverage.
Both holes in the ground.
Both holes in the ground, both 1,000 feet. And to get the large scanning angles would require a more complicated structure than the present Arecibo structure, which is limited to 20 degrees of scan. And the cost was not all that much better than a completely steerable parabola. And the difficulty in feeding the antenna at different frequencies simultaneously was so great that the decision was made, right or wrong by today's standards, not to go in the direction of a large fixed parabola. But the designers, the people who worked on the Arecibo antenna, spent time here at the laboratory with us at Stump Neck on the parabola, although the one at the NRL parabola at Stump Neck, the NRL antenna Stump Neck is a parabola instead of a sphere.
Right.
We were aware of both kinds. And in fact, the one that we proposed for Puerto Rico was a hybrid device, which we call the Marston antenna, which was to have a contact lens of plastic on the surface of the reflector, which permitted greater scan angles. And this was one of the things that slowed it up, was that it took such a large volume of plastic material, which had a carefully controlled dielectric constant.
So what is the gain of this now? It refracts reflected waves slightly, or the transmitted waves?
The system is, I believe, and I'm just talking off the cuff now, with many years since I've remembered it, I believe it's known as the Magnum lens. It's a classic design in which there's a reflector with a lens in contact with it, and a variable.
In visual optics also.
Yes, it's used in light optics as well as radio optics. And we attribute it to Dr. Marston, who was in charge of the antenna techniques group here at the laboratory at that time.
But this never was carried out on a large antenna.
No, it never was done on a large antenna. It is of a class of antennas like the Lundberg lens type, where a plastic is used, although the one that I'm speaking of didn't have the variable density dielectric. Well, I've kind of rambled on here.
Oh, it's been very useful information.
It's
any other points that you can think of to make about anything?
Well, it's been about
Do you have any
10 years since I've hardly even thought of this kind of business. Time.
You said you talked with Jansky at any time, and
Jansky came to the laboratory in the early days of radio astronomy.
I mean, the late 40s,
and met here with various people, including people like Menzel, and talked about the possibilities of radio astronomy. What kind of experiments we should do, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe he came to one meeting where Dr. Page of this laboratory, then the director of research, was making the initial plans for the 600-foot antenna at Sugar Grove. Jansky came and met.
Well, no, he died in 1950.
Oh, no.
You're getting mixed up with his brother, perhaps, Carl. Cyril.
We were into this business, believe it or not. We were into this business as early as 48.
The large reflector.
With large antennas and related to moon work and space work.
We
had large antenna arrays and working on these kind of signals as early as 48.
I see.
So it came very close after the war.
Do you have any feelings as to Jansky's involvement in radio astronomy at that time? He obviously wasn't able to do it at Bell Labs. So.
He was considered kind of a senior scientist, you know. He didn't presume to be an astronomer. and but his position and his organization, Bell Labs, was enough enough to give him prestige, and I think he was well thought of by everybody. And of course, there were very few radio astronomers.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. In the early days, just a handful of people, and.
Do you know anything about? I've heard that he had proposals for a large reflector at Bell Labs, which they weren't willing to build for one reason or another.
Seems like I do remember something about that. They did put up a reflector at Bell Labs eventually. I don't remember whether it was before or after he died. They had one that was, I guess it was used for some of their microwave link studies, or what amounted later came out as microwave links. But they did seem to not to push that side of it very fast.
Yeah.
Of course, they came through with their shooter scoop antenna up in Maine, which was much later.
Yeah, that's been amazing what Bell Labs has contributed to radio astronomy, considering the percentage of time they spent on.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Well,
that's useful.
Happy to talk to you.
On 18 March 75 at NRL, and this is the end of the tape.